Coming up, loaded episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a very good one today with Tom Haverstraw covering what was a really fun week in the NBA. Of course, we hit the Jimmy Butler rumors as well. A couple of things we didn't talk about. Paolo Banchero making his return to the lineup for the Orlando Magic on Friday against the Milwaukee Bucks. He's been out since early November. Pretty awesome that Magic have been able to sustain success over the course of time. As I talked about with my guest Mo on Monday, they've been great. They've been great without Paolo. They were great with Franz. They've been solid, average at least, without both Paolo and Franz. I look forward to seeing Banchero get back from that torn oblique on Friday night. And what is actually a pretty big game. Orlando, just one spot ahead of the Bucks. Milwaukee's in the 5 seed right now, so that's actually a very important game. And then on Thursday night, the Hornets and Lakers game was postponed because of the tragic, heartbreaking fires happening across Los Angeles County. Right now, I don't live in LA anymore. I moved back to Massachusetts. For the people who did reach out to me over email asking about my situation, of course, many others have faced tragedy. Many others, coworkers, former coworkers, friends, have had to evacuate. It's been absolutely horrible to see what's happening out there, and NBA rightfully so. I think they made the correct call in postponing that Hornets-Lakers game on Thursday night. Sending all the best to everybody out in Los Angeles. Hopefully this gets resolved very, very, very soon. On today's podcast, we did not talk about any of the games on Thursday night due to timing with our recording, but here's my conversation with Tom Haverstraw. All right, Tom, let's get straight into it. We got a lot to discuss today, and I want to start off with what was the game of the week. The Cavs and the Thunder, 230 when teams faced off on Wednesday. Cavs won that one at home, 129-122. Extended their win streak to 11, ending a 15-game win streak for the Thunder, minus their loss in the NBA Cup. Tom, I feel like Cleveland has fully, at this point, checked enough boxes to establish themselves as a very, very, very real threat to win the NBA Finals. In your tiers you've been doing at your Substack, you still have them as a 4-star team right behind OKC.
I put them up.
Right
behind I upgraded them. They're a 5-star as of last week. Breaking news. A 5-star, and I thought of you, and I was wondering if you are in the same bucket, so I want to hear your take.
Yes, I am in the same bucket. Look, dude, I think with Cleveland, the big difference between Cleveland and OKC in this game, I felt like, was the bigs. Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, those guys were just, as they have been the entire season, both of them should be all-stars. Mobley should be an all-NBA guy without a doubt so far. Mobley had 21 points, 10 rebounds, 7 assists. Unbelievable down the final stretch of the game. Jared Allen had 25 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists as well. 3 steals. We forget how good of a playmaker Jared Allen is as a 5, but Allen after the game, you know, him and Mobley did their presser together. And Allen sat up there and he's like, we're the best two bigs in the league at protecting the paint together. And the world finally learned who Evan Mobley is, and they still have a lot more to learn. And I thought it was a good quote because it is true. You know, NBA media, ESPN did a great job making this game feel big. There was like a full court press clearly from the NBA to promote. They had me do a AMA on Reddit to help promote the game, whatever that's going to do. Like, there's a full court press that I think for a lot of people tuning in to these two teams riding long win streaks, top of their conference, it was the first time seeing new and improved Evan Mobley. So with this Cleveland team, we talked about their shooting ability, how they just launch a ton of threes. You wrote about that as well. We know about Donovan Mitchell at this point, Darius Garland. We know about their role players, and a lot of people are learning a lot about them in that game as well. But Evan Mobley, more than anything else, stars are what elevate teams to championships, and Evan Mobley looked like, at times, the best player on the floor.
Yeah, let's start there because, you know, I was really upset last night. I had to do the Blazers Pelicans game. So I wasn't upset that I had to do the game. I was
and
upset
you
at the
didn't
time.
Even get Zion, Tom.
I know. It was a bummer. No B.I., no Zion, no Trey Murphy the third. And it showed, as a side note, it showed with the Blazers having their largest halftime lead in like forever, 34 points. But I was upset not that I had to do the game. I was upset that I had to do the game at that time because I have to do the pregame show. And on my screen up here, my TV is locked in on the biggest game of the year, OKC Cleveland. And it felt like a real event. You know, we've talked on this show about how the NBA needs to make more event programming where it feels big. And they did that in the huge marketing push at the league office for this game. They had two days off leading into this game for both teams. And I don't know. They got the script. I guess the NBA got the script because they wrote the script. Because they made this game on Wednesday night, ESPN. Both teams had days off before it. How did they know it was going to be the regular season game of the year? And then it delivered on so many levels. It was at Cleveland, so the crowd was going nuts. You know, I don't think people talk enough about how this team, you know, they had a championship with LeBron, and they had a great run with LeBron before that. But the fact that they're doing this while LeBron is still in the league, and Cleveland is going off to one of the best starts in NBA history. There's only six teams that have gotten off to a 32-4 start to the season. And one of them is this Cleveland Cavaliers team post-LeBron. And that's such a cool story. And Mike Breen did a great job on the game, lending this importance to the game and noting, like, man, this game is in January, but it feels huge. And that's kind of what we want with the NBA, right? We want these regular seasons to feel like every game matters. And it's hard to make a January game between two teams like Cleveland and OKC with their makeup, the young cores, feel like a playoff game seven. But the atmosphere, the media rallied around it, and it was great to see that after all the talk this season, not only was everybody amped up for this game, but the game delivered. What an awesome night for the league.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a great night for the league and anybody tuning in. And for, I mean, the players stepped up to the plate as well, like in a massive way with the way they each performed. Both teams had two days off going into the game. They felt like two prepared coaching staffs with a game plan, and the players all executed at such an elite level from start to finish in the game. It was just a sensational basketball game in every single regard. It was. And so I feel in that sense, like when you talk about playoff basketball with the focus on one team, one opponent, with days off, it was a really good barometer test for both of these teams. And so for OKC, they miss Chet Holmgren. They don't have Alex Caruso, two of their best defenders, Chet being, before he got hurt, one of the 15, 20 best guys in basketball. It'll be different for them when they have Chet sometime down the line if these teams face off in the finals. For Cleveland, they got Isaac Okoro back in that game, played only 13 minutes off the bench. But I felt Cleveland's top-end stars, Mobley, Allen, we talked a little bit about them with what they did in that game, how Mobley finished. But the role players as well, Dean Wade, Ty Jerome, Max Strus, these are names that if you're watching Cavs throughout the year, you know these guys, what they do. They're shooters. Dean Wade's one of the best defenders in basketball. These guys are more than just spot-up guys. Ty Jerome didn't even hit a three in the game, but he's hitting buckets, getting to the paint, playmaking as well. Those guys combined to be 16 for 19 in the game. Strus had 17, Jerome had 15, Wade had 11. Cleveland's depth that they have behind their well-known names, their star players, is one of the reasons why I think they rightfully have moved on your tiers on the same level of Boston. And I think it's because of their depth, right, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, Ty Jerome, he single-handedly ran that 8-0 break, run that they did in the fourth quarter. And
that was awesome.
Let's talk about that. Like, what they did with going to zone against OKC, in the numbers, you can see it. 0.765 points per possession that OKC had against the zone. They scored 13 points on 17 possessions, coinciding with that Ty Jerome run that he had in the fourth quarter. Against the man, 1.137, so almost twice as efficient going against man than they did against the zone. And like, that's the thing where, man, I'm telling you, how many times did you watch this game? I mean, how many times while you're watching this game, KOC, did you think, I can't wait till Chet Holmgren comes back? Because that, for me, was a big part of this, was watching Cleveland penetrate and kick or throw a lob. The vertical spacing where J-Dub has to kind of sink down into the paint and be a rim protector to protect against an Evan Mobley lob or a Dean Wade lob or a Jared Allen lob. The way that the Cavs play tic-tac-toe on offense, if you have Chet Holmgren lingering around the paint, if Isaiah Hartenstein is guarding the pick and roll, and then you got Chet at the bottom, it's a whole lot different than when you got Cason Wallace at the bottom, or Lu Dort at the bottom, or J Dub at the bottom. That, not to say that they're not good in that role, but you're not making those attacks or thinking lob threat if Chet's down there. And so I think that the zone with his spacing and shooting, I think defensively he brings a different dynamic. And according to Andrew Schleck, that I just listened to the Athletics pod after the game, he was saying that Chet Holmgren, in his opinion — he's covering the Oklahoma City Thunder as well as anybody — in his opinion, he's seeing that Chet Holmgren could come back just after the All-Star break. He's going to get maybe 20 games of regular season action coming back from his hip fracture. And Kev, that's huge. We're getting another rematch of these two teams next week. But if Chet Holmgren comes back and Ihart is playing as well as he has, I think this changes everything.
Chet Holmgren was at a Thunder season ticket holder event recently telling fans there that he'll be back soon.
He had his IG where he was showing his workout, like he's putting on his shoes.
Yep,
and exactly. Man, like, you don't do that without confidence that you're coming back soon, right?
100%. He's telling people, season ticket holders at the event recently, that he'll be back soon. Andrew Schleck has plugged in as anybody covering OKC Thunder. He's saying it. Chet's posting about it, as you said, Tom. It seems like we're moving towards Chet coming back very, very soon for Oklahoma City. And I think after the All-Star break, maybe early March, something like that, if we're projecting ahead, that seems about right. And that changes everything for OKC. Like you said, Cleveland's gone to the zone a bit this year. They're third in the NBA, according to Synergy, in zone usage on defense. Behind Miami, number one, no surprise there. They're always number one. Philly as well, 7.5% of the time on defense. Cleveland is third at 6% of the time they're playing zone on defense. And it works magnificently in that stretch. And that's where, for OKC, you're like, damn, like, if we get to face this team again in June, maybe it'll be different at that time with Chet.
In June, and guess what, Kev, though? In June, I love it. I love it.
We get to see him play next Thursday. I'm fired up about that. That's going to be nice. I know, still no Chet at that point, but man, it was an awesome game, dude. It was just a truly, truly awesome game. And I also just loved the celebration from the Cavs at the end. Like, they were hugging each other. After the game on the local Cleveland broadcast, Evan Mobley was interviewed, and Serena Winters, their great sideline reporter, said, you know, vote Evan for All-Star. And he, like, kind of goes back to the mic, and he grabs him, and he's like, vote All-Star for all four of us. It's just a team with togetherness that plays together. And OKC very much wired the same way. These are both lovable rosters, both of them.
Yeah, Kenny Atkinson has done a marvelous job, you know, being this head coach who comes in after the Nets tenure, goes to the Warriors, thinks about the Charlotte Hornets, and then comes into this Cleveland Cavaliers situation where I'll be honest, I didn't see anything close to this. I didn't even have them on my title tiers before the season. And now they're a five-star title tier up there with OKC and Boston. Like, that says a lot about Kenny Atkinson and the way that he's unlocked Evan Mobley, the big-to-big actions that they're running, and the fact that Evan Mobley's running pick and rolls, Jared Allen's throwing lobs to Evan Mobley. It's just beautiful basketball. And what I loved about Kenny Atkinson, he had a sideline report, I think it was with Cassidy, where Cassidy Hubbard, amazing job at ESPN. She was talking to Kenny Atkinson in between a break, and Kenny's like, man, I wish I could just sit back and watch this game. Like, this is great basketball. And Kev, this is it, man. This is what it's all about. You have to make the games the priority. That's the thing that the NBA is going to have to do a better job of going forward, is we have to do more of this, where the game matters. The game. Kenny Atkinson saying during the game, this game is so great, I wish I could just sit back and watch it on TV. Like, we have to make these games feel important, and the players made it feel important. The league made it feel important. We, of course, have a big job, a big responsibility in promoting the actual game. And I think it all came together on Wednesday night. And yeah, I was watching out of the corner of my eye with the Pelicans and Blazers game, going to be honest.
It was a great one. And hopefully next year, NBA is going to have, obviously, new broadcast partners. Amazon will be carrying games. NBC, you know, they did an amazing job in the 90s. NBC does a great job with their local broadcasts as well. So hopefully NBC nationally does a great job as well. And of course, ESPN will continue to as well. But if this game felt like a big event. It felt like something you have to tune into. And that's the difference between the NBA versus other sports. The NBA operates off of bulk, 82 game regular season, tons of games. Every single night, there's always something on. Other games, there's Sunday NFL, a ton of games on, but it's an event tuning in on Sundays. Yep. And this Wednesday felt like a big event, especially with the game that came after it too.
Yeah. And before we get to that, I just want to make this point. It's uncharted territory where we're at right now with the Cleveland Cavaliers being 32-4 without a guy. What do I mean by that? The other 32-4 teams are better. Listen to this list. You got the 2016 Golden State Warriors. They had Steph. Okay. Winning MVP, amazing all-time player. 96 Bulls, 97 Bulls, the 67 Sixers with Wilt, the 72 Lakers with Wilt, this 81 76ers with Dr. J in his MVP year. The Cleveland Cavaliers are on that list. They don't have a guy that you can say he's the MVP this year. And I think that's what's so troubling for fans. I don't know if troubling is the right word, but the thing that is so confusing for fans is like all those other teams that have been this good this late in the season, they had an all-time great, a Hall of no doubt Hall of Famer, top 10, top 15 player all time on their roster. And that's what's so amazing. What Kenny Atkinson has done is you have to think about it. If I ask you, Kev, right now, who's the best player on the Cavs? You have to think about it. You have to be, like Donovan Mitchell probably, but then Evan Mobley, the way he's playing, but Jared Allen, he was the best guy on the floor. They don't have a singular talent that they built everything around. This is a team. And this is the first team, capital T team, that has gone this well, 32-4 at this point in the season.
These teams, these capital T teams, I think it's a beautiful thing the NBA has one of them, because team is often what is defining NFL rosters. I know you're promoting quarterbacks and all that, but teams have an identity. This Cavs team has a clear identity. And OKC has an identity. They also have a potential MVP in SGA, but it is a team collectively. Mm-hmm. It's not just SGA. And Boston has a clear identity too. So the best teams in the NBA right now, I think it's should be very easy for the NBA to market these groups. And maybe we end up with an OKC Cleveland finals. At the time there will be talk, people will be saying it'll be the worst rated finals ever, these two small markets. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe people will watch these teams throughout the postseason and be like, oh, wow, basketball is actually really fun. Yep. There's a lot of great teams to watch and tune into. I like the way these teams play together. I like the way they defend. Blah, 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 blah. We'll see come June. I think it would be awesome if we get these teams. One team that we will not get is the Spurs. They're not quite ready to be an NBA Finals team. I thought that was very apparent against the Bucks. I mean, it was probably one of Wemby's worst games we've seen since that early season stretch when he got off to a sluggish start first 10 games. Giannis just completely shut him out. Giannis was his typical dominant self, 25 points, 16 rebounds, 8 assists, and he defended Wemby a lot, completely locked him up, forced a turnover 24-second violation in the second half. Wemby ended up with only 10 points on 4 of 10. He had 3 turnovers, and Tom... I was watching back the game again this morning before recording the podcast with you. And it's just amazing how many instances Wemby was just passive in this game. Like he had a play where AJ Green was on him and Giannis kind of shaded over to double, but then Wemby tossed it out of bounds instead of making a spin baseline when he had a lot of room. There was a play he had Middleton on a post up and he just took a shot over him without even trying to make an aggressive move. There was a play in transition. Nobody in the paint. Wemby's bringing the ball up Giannis style. Nobody in the paint for the Bucks. And he just makes a terrible pass to a cutter instead of attacking into the paint himself, a wide open paint. So, I think on one hand I watch this game and it's like Giannis is obviously more developed, has a better supporting cast at this point. As San Antonio has surrounded Wemby with a bunch of gunners. Wemby was 5th on the team in shots, but it's also on Victor sometimes to take that initiative. He can't allow himself to be 5th in shots per game. And I felt like this was one of those games where that was pretty apparent. Both of those factors were Victor still needs to figure out that balance between scorer and playmaker, But the Spurs roster as well doesn't have a lot of those guys to help lift him up like Giannis does.
Yeah, what a great moment when Giannis locked up Wemby out on that perimeter play. I mean, dude, those are the moments sick. That like it's just so fun to watch. And that's, again, how you market this NBA.
Greek freak and a French freak.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
And
it was
Giannis
so cool.
cared, man. He really cared about this matchup. You could tell that he wanted to crush Wemby. And I wrote the column that saying
and
that
he did.
He did absolutely crush him. And he followed through on that in ways that I think, again, we need players to care this much about a regular season game. And I think the whole lead up into the game, I wrote the column for Yahoo Sports that's saying like the future of the NBA is Wemby and it's not Giannis. It's not SGA. It's not the Cavs. The people are so magnetically attracted to Wemby because of his on-court stuff, just the alien nature of his game and like pulling up for threes from 30 feet and then doing things around the rim we've never seen. And he has that like little scoop layup thing at the rim on Giannis. And then Giannis locks him up at the perimeter earlier. And it's just, he can't do anything against Giannis. Amazing theater individually. But let's not ignore the fact that Wemby had the lowest usage rate game of his career. Last two seasons, he has not had a 16.6 usage rate in any game until last night in this matchup against Giannis, where Giannis just clamped him up tons of times. So 16.6% usage rate, what that means is he was on his team's possessions, only using 16% of the team's possessions to attempt to score. And that is a tiny number, especially in a national TV game against a team that was really struggling, moving Chris Middleton to the bench because he's dealing with ankle issues. And you're seeing Wemby really deliver, over-deliver in the Christmas Day game and thereafter. But this one was the first time in a long time I said, he looks like 20 years old out there, Kev.
Yeah, he did look 20 years old. And the Spurs still looked like a young team, too. I felt like watching those games back-to-back, you get to see OKC go into Cleveland, missing some key players, and they still are competitive all the way to the end. And it's an awesome game, clearly between two finals contenders. And then you watch the Spurs and the Bucks. And obviously the Bucks have been an up and down team this season, but they have an MVP candidate in Giannis. They still have some high level role players. Brook Lopez had a big game himself. And then you see the Spurs, and it just, in my mind, it really just showed how massive the gap is between OKC and San Antonio. Like when you think about that Chet Victor rivalry that hopefully brews. Hopefully we get a Thunder 1 seed, Spurs 8 seed round 1 series, but that series isn't going to be close. It's just not going to be close. The Spurs are nowhere close. They're not at all.
They need a guy to get to the cup. They had 30 points in the paint against this Giannis and Brook Lopez front line. And that's a really good front line when they're locked in, of course. But 30 points in the paint is atrocious. Second lowest of the season for the Spurs. And they're bottom five in drives per game in the NBA. The Spurs are. So they need a guy who can get into the paint, penetrate, and get the defense in a grinder so that things open up for Wemby. Some attacking lanes. So he's not strong enough to just go right at Giannis, as we saw in that game. He just doesn't have the strength. He, like ISO, he's going to have a couple plays where you're just like, how did he do that? And it's because of that just dexterity and the length and the creativity. But they need someone, and this was the same issue that the Warriors had with Chris Paul, is they need someone to get into the paint and start that kind of rotational blender. And they don't have that guy right now, Steph Castle, starting next to Vassell. And I like the look. I like the starting five, but they still weren't able to get downhill and get the Milwaukee Bucks in rotation or push the ball in transition. They were raining from downtown. They took over 53-pointers, which isn't really their DNA, but I think it underscores, man, they really need a guy who can get to the cup. And dude, I'm telling you, we just did a big number with Dan Devine that dropped this week about the Sacramento Kings. I'm just saying, the way that the Kings have looked without De'Aaron Fox and the way that it's been kind of awkward with De'Aaron Fox this season off the court, on the court, he's fourth in the NBA in drives per game. Fourth. And the Spurs are bottom five. I'm just saying, Kev. I'm just saying.
Look, I think Fox would be a nice acquisition for the Spurs. He definitely fits the profile of what you need next to Wemby. Nice downhill attacker. somebody who can get into the teeth of the defense, kick out, draw in help, and create lob opportunities for Victor. I mean, look, no disrespect to Chris Paul. He has been helpful with making that offense at times look competent this season, but he is so far beyond his prime with his ability to get into the paint as an undersized point guard, as a guy who even in his prime wasn't somebody finishing at a high rate, high frequency at the rim. He's always been a bit more perimeter based. His tool utility of getting to the paint was to create for others. And he just can't get there consistently anymore. And that to me is a huge drawback for the Spurs offense, which, you know, with Harrison Barnes and Devin Vassell and Stephon Castle and Keldon Johnson, these guys aren't playmakers. They're finishers. Some of them are shot chuckers, Keldon Johnson. Like they need a point guard who can create and penetrate. And they also need a supporting cast that could be more like Cleveland's. Like, where's your Max Strus's? Where's your Ty Jerome? Like, where is your Dean Wade? These are the guys that you need to surround Victor with. And over the course of time, you know, maybe the Spurs are able to find those guys. But right now, the roster just doesn't make sense around Victor. They don't want enough through him. He's a better playmaker than he's given opportunities to show. And they don't have a point guard that can help elevate Victor to the level that he can with those 80% finishing opportunities that he should get pretty consistently. It just doesn't happen. It's rare you see Victor catch a lob. And for a 7'4" guy, it should not be a rare thing. And so the Spurs have a hell of a lot of work to do before they're just like, oh yeah, maybe we'll see a 1-8 seed. Nice story against OKC in the first round. But we'll see if they even make the playoffs. That is not a certainty either. Tom, quick reminder to the listeners, subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show if you have not done so already. Let's get some 5-star ratings over on Spotify and Apple. It really does help with the show. We'll be right back. Okay, Tom, we got some big returns this week. Zion Williamson, you didn't get to see him against your Portland Trail Blazers, but he did return the night before against the Minnesota Timberwolves. He had 22 points on 15 shots, 6 boards, 4 assists, 3 steals, 1 block. I thought it was the best he looked all season long. He looked lean. He looked in shape. He looked like he had his energy on the defensive end of the floor on that windmill dunk that went super viral on social media, the 360 windmill. It was after a strip at half court. We kind of flew in, stole the ball. He had a game. He had a play earlier where he had a block on Rudy Gobert. He took the ball away from Julius Randle, defending him man-to-man. He was active. He was doing all the typical Zion stuff on offense as well. But I thought the defensive activity from him that night and just the way he looked physically, I felt like this is like clearly he was doing a lot of work with this time off. We haven't seen him since November. So I came away very, very impressed. What were your first impressions of Zion, Tom?
He played so well, I want to trade him. I'll explain.
Sell high.
Like he was so good in that debut, but the team that I watched on Wednesday night, it was depressing, honestly. It was watching a shell of a team, and I'm looking at the New Orleans Pelicans getting down by 30 points in the first half and just wondering, like, what's the roadmap here? Like, what is the roadmap going forward? Is Zion Williamson a part of this team going forward? Is he still the face of the franchise? Or do they say, look, we have to sell high when he's healthy and doing great things like he did on Tuesday night and energetic, making defensive plays, barreling to the rim, dunking like that. There's going to be a team in the league if you string enough of these games together, and this is really hard to do with Zion, who can't stay healthy, is you have to sell high. And it's so hard for teams because it's kind of this catch 22. If Zion starts playing well and you hold on to him, but then he gets hurt, you can't move him because no one's going to trade for that guy. But if he started playing well, you can start to convince yourself, hey, man, what if he can finally do it for us? And he did it in the postseason, well, in the play-in game last year, where it was just like, dude, if that guy is that guy for 70 games out of the year and does it in the playoffs, they have something. But I just feel like this organization needs a reset. And the way that the season has gone, it looks like Cooper Flagg might be coming down the pike. And I don't want a situation where Cooper Flagg looks at the New Orleans Pelicans getting the number one overall pick and doesn't feel like there's a plan here. And so I feel like Zion Williamson with this, right, Kev, with this game, my first impulse is they got to figure out a way to move him, because this is kind of like their window right now. Is Zion's healthy, looking good? Maybe there's no better opportunity than to move him now.
I mean, it's the challenge is finding something that's worth giving up on that guy. Giving up on this guy who looks like one of the 10 or so best players in the league when he's healthy. Like, what are you going to get from a team that makes you feel like, okay, let's trade this 24-year-old who looks like a dominant force anytime he's healthy for any sustained period of time? That's the challenge in finding a deal that makes any sense. So I think, you know, earlier this week, my guest on the show, Mo Dekeel, mentioned, you know, the Warriors as a team that should go for Zion Williamson. Mark Spears from And Space ESPN came out and said that he's heard the Warriors don't want Zion. I don't know who they want. Like, they don't seem to want anybody. We'll talk about the Warriors in a second. But I just have a hard time thinking of what team would want Zion and what team would give me enough to want to give him up. Like for New Orleans, you have him signed. He's under team control like through 2028. And at his peak, he's going to make $44 million in 2028. That's a lot of money, but it's not $60 million. It's not $70 million like you're going to see some guys making on these contracts over the next handful of years. I just have a hard time imagining that there's a deal out there that's worth doing. So do you have anybody in mind? Like, is there a team where you're like, this could be a match? Because I have a hard time there, Tom. It's tough. Because I agree. I would love to sell high. But where's the buyer that makes sense for me? That's where I'm struggling.
Okay, I'll give you one. I'll give you one right here.
Okay.
San Antonio Spurs.
Ooh. Oh.
Third in the NBA in drives per game is Zion Williamson. Mm. Get that guy going downhill, and then you got this dude, Victor Wembanyama. Two of the most, I think, magnetic stars is Duke. When Zion was at Duke, and then you get Wemby on the same team, you want to make appointment viewing. I argue that Wemby is appointment viewing. You want real appointment viewing in the NBA? Watching Wemby and Zion, Kev.
Could this be Dallas trading for Kristaps Porzingis, though? Trying to make it work too soon with Luka?
It could be, but I also think we run the risk of having a Cleveland Cavaliers with LeBron where it just never, it never comes together. So I can argue both ways of that is if they just sit here with this generational talent and don't build around him, he's going to leave just like LeBron did and just be like, I've got to create my own future. And that's what you're risking with Victor Wembanyama is, let's say if Luka and Giannis come together, let's say Anthony Edwards and another, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, whatever it is, if these two young studs come together and Wemby's out there by himself and be like, who's my co-pilot? Who's my guy? And maybe we think Castle develops into that. But for me, I don't want another situation where we're watching the first 6-7 years of Wemby the same way we did with LeBron and say, what if? Because Kobe had Shaq when he came in and Shaq came there in LA and they came together and won championships together. If LeBron had anyone close to the guy who was Shaq in 2000 and right at the end of the 1990s, we would have a totally different appreciation for LeBron's talents. It would rewrite LeBron's story if he came into the league with a guy as good as, I'm not saying Zion is Shaq, but I just want Wemby to have a co-pilot, a co-star, and hopefully we don't have a situation where we're looking back in the same way we did with LeBron.
It's an interesting idea because the Spurs are a team. They have some salaries they can move. They have a surplus of draft picks that they can move, a lot of them with great value as well. It's not like they just have picks by quantity. They have picks with quality. So I could see some mutual interest there. To me, I think with Zion's salary, the reason why I said New Orleans maybe, you know, decide to keep it is also the reason why a younger team like the Spurs could say, you know what, screw it. We'll make this our swing for the Wemby rookie contract years. And then if towards the end of it, it's not working out, well, he's a near expiring guy at $42 million or $44 million. So for the Spurs, it's an interesting idea. That's probably the best idea I've heard for a Zion destination. It's probably the best. Yeah, and
they've got the stuff, the assets that New Orleans would want. David Griffin has to look at this organization and say, you know, are we really going to be building around Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson going forward? And they probably will look at this and say, Trey Murphy, we're going to build around whoever's coming down the draft. What, maybe they get lucky, they get Cooper Flagg or Ace Bailey or Dylan Harper, one of these, you know, core guys that you can build around. But I feel like the sun is setting when it comes to this iteration of the New Orleans Pelicans. And I don't want to make too much of this one game that I was brought, just happened to watch, but it looked like something has to give. And it's bleak in New Orleans, and Zion and Brandon Ingram. I mean, maybe you say, hey, they're going to reload like the Spurs did with David Robinson and Tim Duncan. Like, why not? And the why not is because I just feel like it's run its course. And if your peak of B.I. and Zion Williamson is maybe the play-in, maybe winning a first round series, maybe you just have to move on.
Now, a different franchise where things feel like they may have run their course after many years of success, unlike the Pelicans, is the Golden State Warriors. Big story this week with Stephen Curry talking on the record about the two timeline stuff. He said the postmortem on some of the two timeline stuff is not great. We picked Wiseman, who's had a rough go. Not his fault, but we had the number two pick and we picked Wise. I mean, it was a pretty honest quote from him in a story where he was talking about the clock's ticking. Like he says he wants to play as long as he can, but he knows the clock is ticking. And then you had Steve Kerr after a Warriors loss this week where he's talking about how his team can't get to the basket, how they're near the bottom of the league in free throws and baskets at the rim. And he says it's the personnel. And then he's asked about, well, is there any trades that could be made? And he says, these are questions for Mike, referring to Mike Dunleavy, their general manager. So I think for Golden State, you know, it's been years really of the front office and ownership, the Lacob family talking about it's hard to make trades. It's tough to trade for stars. Meanwhile, stars are getting traded everywhere, every year around the NBA, and the Warriors are sitting on their hands. Now, maybe you could argue that they were fortunate to whiff on Paul George, who has not looked great for Philadelphia, or fortunate to whiff on Lauri Markkanen, who has had a down year this year for the Utah Jazz. But you still have Stephen Curry performing at an elite level. You still have Draymond Green performing at an elite level defensively and shooting nearly 40% from three on top of his typical playmaking. But the Warriors are right at 500 basically the entire year after their fast start. This feels like a team that they have to do something. And if they don't do something, to me, their actions just once again will indicate that this is a team that doesn't actually want to go all in around Stephen Curry and Draymond Green. That's what I would feel like if they don't do anything this February leading into the offseason, that they just actually are ready to move on from the era and they actually want those guys to ask out for trades. Because so far, all indications, all their actions are that they don't want to make a trade. So prove me wrong. I'd love to see that from Golden State. I'd love to see them make a deal, Tom.
I would too. And I bet Steph Curry would too. Like, that's the guy who matters. That's the guy who matters. They're 6-15 in their last 21 games with Steph Curry. Steph Curry has been healthy for the majority of that run.
Awful.
6-15. They've got 5 games in the last month where they failed to break 100 points with Steph Curry in the lineup. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. The roster around Stephen Curry needs to be better, needs to be upgraded. You can't have a guy who's still that good and they can't break 100 in an era where 100 is the new 80. Like, teams are regularly breaking 100 and they can't do it against the Sacramento Kings? Like, come on now. This needs an ad. Like, they need to press the button. They need to press the button yesterday. And it's not Dennis Schroeder. That's not the guy. Maybe that's the guy before the guy, but it's not going to be Cam Johnson. It can't be something like that. I think it has to be larger. Jimmy Butler, if Steph Curry and Draymond Green wanted Jimmy Butler, I think that deal would have been done by now. I think both sides are motivated to get a deal, but it is obvious to me that, like, Jimmy Butler and the Warriors has not been louder, and yet you have Stephen Curry, you know, talking a little bit more than usual. But I feel like the Warriors have an incentive to upgrade and get star power. The Miami Heat have an incentive to upgrade and move on from the Jimmy Butler era. And yet there is no deal. And it seems to me that the Golden State Warriors are dangerously close to a time when Steph Curry this offseason says, like, I've had enough with this. Like, what are we doing? And you hear the little chirping there in that story. But I can tell you, like, Stephen Curry, a guy of that talent, of that caliber, and that legacy all time, deserves much better than what he's getting right now.
Yeah, he absolutely does. And I mean, we'll see what the Warriors end up doing. And one place I will say that the Lakers aren't totally wrong when it comes to it being hard to make a trade is it would be hard to trade for Jimmy Butler because of his salaries and the salaries that they do have. It is tough from the roster limits with the amount of salaries you would have to put together. You would have to add more teams, but it's not impossible. It's not impossible to do if you really did want to go out and get Jimmy Butler. So I think they have to do something. You have to make a move to try to capitalize on the end of this era. And if not, hey, don't be surprised if Stephen Curry is demanding a trade this offseason. Speaking about Jimmy Butler, Tom, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and talk more about him. Okay, Tom, we've talked a hell of a lot about Jimmy Butler in recent weeks on this podcast. Maybe you're tired of hearing about him. Part of me is tired of talking about Jimmy Butler, but there seems to always be something new with Jimmy Butler with this saga. Earlier this week, Chris Haynes posted on X saying that he heard that the Jimmy Butler camp told the Grizzlies no, he does not want to play there. I followed up reporting that I had heard a lot of rumblings that the Bucks were also told kind of to back off, that they are not a preferred destination for him. Now, that has since been reported elsewhere as well with Memphis and Milwaukee. One thing I've heard that I don't think I've seen out there is that maybe don't think about the Bucks as the Butler team. That the Bucks don't need to be involved for Butler. That they can be involved in a different way. And that made me think, could Milwaukee be the Bradley Beal team? Because we're looking everywhere around the league. Who's going to take on Bradley Beal? What if it's the team that just moved Chris Middleton to the bench after he's suffering from ankle issues and really struggling lately after having double ankle surgery last offseason? Maybe it's them. Maybe it's the Bucks that could be the Bradley Beal team. And so nobody has said that directly to me, that watch out for the Bucks. To be clear, nobody has said watch out for the Bucks as Bradley Beal, but I have been told the Bucks can be involved in a Butler deal without being the team that gets Jimmy Butler. So that's just something to think about here because they have incentive to keep trying to win. Bradley Beal today in this particular moment is better than Middleton. Middleton has really struggled as of late after having some good games earlier in the season. And I'd take Middleton most days, but if he's going to struggle because of the ankle issues, the Bucks would know that better than anybody. And know that maybe they have to gamble on somebody else to make the most of Giannis in these coming years. You can argue pretty easily against Bradley Beal as a plan for them, but what else is really out there for Milwaukee? So that's just something for people to think about, nibble on that. Like maybe the Bucks get involved in some other type of way in this deal, and maybe it's not Bradley Beal. Maybe it's something else, but Milwaukee and all these teams involved with Jimmy Butler right now, you also have Kendrick Perkins, Tom, who reported on ESPN on Thursday morning that he was told that Jimmy Butler has a 2-year extension ready to go from the Phoenix Suns if he ends up re-signing, if he ends up getting traded there. And I have, you know, since in December said like it is a lot about the money for Jimmy Butler here. Memphis, Milwaukee, I'm not so sure those teams would give him a long-term extension, whereas clearly the Phoenix Suns would. Now, we'll see how this all shakes out. I'm not convinced Pat Riley is going to give Jimmy Butler what he wants. I'm not. He might just sit on his hands and go into this offseason, assume Butler's going to opt out, and have a clean slate and a lot of flexibility. But that's the latest that I've heard this week. It's kind of a little recap. What's on your mind, Tom, with everything we know about Jimmy Butler right now?
It's the Detroit one. That one is still pretty tantalizing to me. And I think it might go up into the 11th hour here because I think both sides, Detroit and Phoenix, probably want to just see this through and wait until they absolutely need to press that button. But again, to recap, as I wrote on TomTheFinder.com this weekend, is Detroit is kind of this weird feeder system for the Phoenix Suns franchise. Mark Bartlestein, the agent for Bradley Beal, is the father of Josh Bartlestein, the CEO for the Phoenix Suns. And where did Josh Bartlestein get his start in the NBA? It was with Arne Tellem, who's running the Detroit Pistons, longtime super agent Arne Tellem, who hired Josh Bartlestein as an assistant chief of staff, and then he rose to become an assistant GM and then took the CEO job. And that's not all. Arne Tellem's son was hired this offseason by the Phoenix Suns, Matt Tellem, to be an assistant general manager for the Phoenix Suns. So it's almost like this family business, this operation between Detroit and Phoenix, and involving Bradley Beal, his agent's son is running the Phoenix Suns, and then the Pistons' son is working in the same front office. And so if he gets on the phone and just says, "Hey, Dad, we got to figure out the situation with Bradley Beal. I know you're close with Mark. Let's figure this thing out. What's it going to take?" And they might be looking at this and saying, "We don't want Bradley Beal. Like, why do we want Bradley Beal? We've got this young group coming up. They look like they're going to make the playoffs. Why would we add two more years at 50 plus of Bradley Beal? Obviously going to pick up that player option. But what if they say, look, we'll give you an extension, but it's going to be at like $30 million. You're going to waive that player option in 27. And you can be that bridge. You can be the guy who's filling in for Jaden Ivey this season and being kind of this like folk hero, comes into Detroit, helps them make that playoff push next to Cade Cunningham, who is his play is demanding somebody of that caliber, someone next to him that can help them win games in the postseason. Like, they're ready. They're ready for a guy like Bradley Beal. It might not happen, but I think that's the most likely third team. You talked about Milwaukee earlier. I wonder if Detroit gets into this and says, all right, we'll take on Bradley Beal. We have a weird like front office tryst or family incestuous thing going on with Phoenix, but it makes sense for us to build that bridge for the future. And Bradley Beal could be that guy that, you know what, like takes up a bunch of their cap. Yes. But who else are they going to give that money to?
Yeah, I mean, look, you got to pay somebody if you're Detroit. I supported that earlier in the week after I saw you post your article on social media. I like the idea. Pistons fans hate the idea. Most Pistons fans seem to really dread the idea of Bradley Beal. I'm like, he's not as bad as he's being painted to be. Like, he's not the same guy he was.
What's the opportunity cost? Like, the opportunity cost, like, if you get Bradley Beal, what are you missing out on? Like,
well, and if you do get Bradley Beal as well, you might also get the pot could be sweetened with a future pick. Like, you might get a future first in that too, and that asset could lead you to be making a trade when Bradley Beal's an expiring down the line to get you that guy. That asset could end up being super valuable down the line. And Beal, look, all the questions about fit with Jaden Ivey, he doesn't quite shoot well enough. He doesn't play off ball quite enough. All these questions. That's what Bradley Beal does. That's what he can do. He's still a near 40% guy from three. He's still really good off of handoffs. He can run some pick and roll for you, but he can be that second guy. And he has been for a long time, except for those years he was a 30 plus point per game guy. So yes, he's expensive. Yes, he's overpaid. Yes, he's not the same guy he used to be. But Detroit does make some sense to me as the Bradley Beal destination. We'll see if they actually end up doing that. They might have their sights somewhere else. Maybe they'd want to go for Zach LaVine or somebody like that instead. But the player construct next to Cade is still the same vibe we're talking about.
Right. And that's going to be pretty interesting. Is Pat Riley on the phone with Arne Tellem and with Bartlestein and Matt Ishbia and James Jones figuring out where is that 2031 Phoenix Suns pick going to go? Is it going to go to Detroit because they're taking on the Bradley Beal contract with his no trade clause? Remember, Bradley Beal's no trade clause does not get waived. It does not get nulled when he goes to a new team. It's for the life of the contract. So maybe Arne Tellem's like, hey, we need that 2031 assurance to offset the risk of this no trade clause. And Pat Riley's like, we're not giving you Jimmy Butler. And then Matt Ishbia is sitting there being like, all right, fine, we'll grease the wheels on this trade and send you the 2031 pick. And then Detroit's like, we're not doing the deal. And so it's going to be like hot potato in these negotiations. Who's going to get that 2031 to grease the wheels on a Jimmy Butler contract or to take the Bradley Beal no trade clause? It's fascinating. For me, I think the Detroit one makes the most sense. Does it make great sense? No, I'm not saying that. But in terms of like a pick your poison of how do we figure out a way to get Jimmy Butler into Phoenix, you're going to have to find a place for Bradley Beal. And Detroit makes the most sense that I can see of all the teams that might be in the running.
So with Miami, the other factor right now for them is they currently owe their pick to the Oklahoma City Thunder, but it's top 14 protected. So if the Heat don't make the playoffs, they get to keep their draft pick. Pat Riley has never been somebody to tank, but they're only three games back from the eighth worst record in basketball, which would come with a 26% chance at winning a top four pick, a 6% chance at landing the number one pick. And that number one pick this year, Tom, it continues to be very clear that it's Cooper Flagg to me. He had 19 points on 11 shots this last game he played on Tuesday, 10 boards, 5 assists. He leads Duke in points, rebounds, assists, steals, blocks. Duke has the number one defense in the nation, according to KenPom. He leads that defense as well. You saw him at that game on Tuesday. What were your takeaways with Cooper Flagg? Do you agree with me that he's very, very clearly the number one guy?
This guy was 17 a couple weeks ago. I can't believe that. He was by far the strongest, the best player on the floor in that game. And it was stunning, stunning how competitive this guy was. Every single play he was getting after it. He was looking over at John Shire for the play calls. He wasn't in the first half, he got in some foul trouble, but the strength that he has, the blocking shots, the way he can run your offense, the handle, he looks like to me, like he can be a Jokic. He can be a guy who can be the fulcrum of your offense in the same way that we see with Zion, with Jokic, where it's like, you want point Cooper Flagg? He's good enough. What's great about going to Cameron Indoor beyond the fan, the Cayman Crazies, it's an awesome place. If anyone has like, maybe I'll go this year, you got to go. It is an amazing, amazing place to watch a game. But one of the primary reasons why I love it is because the vibration of the court, when these guys are going at it, the place it's like a high school gym. And the seats, the bleachers that I was sitting on, I was like five rows up. I was sitting in these like wooden bleachers that are like, it feels like you're on the floor. And when Cooper Flagg is going downhill, and when he had that dunk, that poster on the pit big man, you felt it. You felt it, the strength that Cooper Flagg has. And he just turned 18. He went up a class to play at Duke this year and then proved he's the best player in the nation. And I Jeff Capel, whose father had ALS, which is part of the reason why we had this Hoops for ALS game to raise awareness for ALS. My mother passed away from ALS. And so Jeff Capel and I, we started this committee to try to raise awareness through basketball. And John Shire, after the game, gave him a shout out to Jeff Capel and his late father. They were on the coaching staff together at Duke when Jeff Capel's father passed away from the disease. And Jeff Capel, after the game, was like, hey, I just want to say something. Like, the biggest difference between Duke this year and last year is the leadership of Cooper Flagg. The way that guy plays basketball, everyone is just a totally different player. They ramp it up because Cooper Flagg ramps it up. And the leadership that he has is the biggest difference between this team and last year. He didn't say it, but the Kyle Filipowski, Jared McCain team last year that I got a chance to see in person, it's like a whole different mindset when Cooper Flagg is that dude, is running your offense in both ends of the floor. I mean, I'm telling you, like if he was a free agent right now, if we had this thing where it like the draft was just completely abolished and we went to a free agent scenario for these guys entering the league, I don't know how much teams would pay for him, but he would command a huge contract with how good he is this young.
30 plus million for damn sure.
Oh,
probably no, more than that. Probably 40 plus.
40 plus guaranteed from day one. The way
he's ready to play.
Yo,
he's ready.
He's running.
Yes, exactly. He does everything, and he'll get better at it over the course of time. But like, he's already a high level defender, regardless of the level of competition. There's like a foundation you can rely on him in different positions defensively: shot blocking, help defense, energy, rebounding, going around screens, switching on ball against quicker guys, bigger guys. He's a great defender, period. Offensively, the versatility plug and play into different roles. I mean, I know like when listeners might hear you say Jokic, you don't mean like elite savant passer necessarily. You mean the role, the construct. He can do the Zion thing, rumbling downhill, or you can put him at the elbows. You can put him anywhere. You can use him as a screener too. You can have him fly off of a screen into a handoff and just slingshot towards the rim like we've seen the Pelicans do with Zion over the years. He can be used anywhere.
And great and passer, that's man.
He is a really good passer. And that's the thing with Cooper, man. It's that versatility. Like he had a mid-range step back in that game. Like the poster dunk is what went viral, buddy. He had a lefty spin out of the post. He had some cuts. He scored off of screens. Like just the level of versatility from this guy on both ends of the floor is so high level, dude. Like it's insane. And he sets a tone for your team on top of that. Like to me, he's, I mean, look, the other prospects, Dylan Harper, Ace Bailey, these other guys that are going to be in the conversation, they're really good prospects, but they're not Cooper Flagg. The Cooper Flagg to me, he's not moving off of number one. Something dramatic would have to happen for that to change. Tom, I want to talk about our other number one prospect from this past year's draft. Reed Sheppard has not been a great year for him with the Houston Rockets. He's been in the doghouse, on the bench. Not really in the doghouse. That's not fair. It's a rotation that's deep. They have a lot of guys playing ahead of a rookie in Reed Sheppard, but he got sent to the G League, made his debut on Tuesday for the Rio Grande Valley Vipers, and woo! Reed Sheppard showing out! 49 points, 8 assists, 5 boards, 3 steals, 1 block. That's what you want to see from a rookie when he gets sent to the G League. And boy, it felt good to see him do that after a lot of concern this year from Reed Sheppard, because damn, he was scoring in every way. Mid-range, fadeaways, pull-up, threes. Houston even sent him through the elevator doors, the old Stephen Curry action, and he drained a three out of that. He was playmaking. He was scoring. He was trying to lead his team back. They didn't quite get the win against the OKC Blue, but boy, Reed Sheppard looked good in the G League.
I'm like crawling through the desert, looking for water, just looking anywhere. And I'm just, and the sun's beating down. It's looking pretty bleak over there on Reed Sheppard Island. And then suddenly there's this giant fresh waterfall that appears out of nowhere and delivers that for us, Kev. What an amazing statement from Reed Sheppard, who has been glued to the bench, couldn't find his shot, couldn't find his rhythm. I'm starting to doubt myself. Like, was last year a total aberration? Was this whole second generation, this kid who's just got great feel for the game, well-coached, coming into Houston and just loses all of that basketball aura gone? And yet he goes to Rio Grande and just completely justifies all of our love for Reed Sheppard's game. And in one game, it's G League. But it made me feel so good. It was an early birthday present. Today's my birthday, Kev. And I felt like
Tom.
I got my birthday present right there. Is a G League game from Reed Sheppard that re-inspires me to lead this bandwagon with you on the Reed Sheppard.
Tom, happy birthday. That's awesome. What a great birthday present. Couldn't have asked for anything better after last week.
Oh, my God. It was dark, man. Reed. Kev, it was dark out on Reed Sheppard Island. It was tough.
I was having Killian flashbacks last Friday. Now I'm seeing Steph again.
Yes. One G League game is all it took. All it took against Oklahoma City's G League team in a dimly lit gym with 157 odd people there. Now
most
we believe.
Most of them scouts.
Reed Sheppard, man. He looks so good. I watched the highlights and I was tearing up. Oh, man. Yeah. It was great.
It was an absolutely beautiful thing. Hopefully, Reed continues to have some good games in the G League for Houston, because I'm still a believer in Reed. I think he's got too much talent, too much skill, too much feel. Tom, thanks for joining me today. Happy birthday, man.
Thank you. Thank you. If 39 is as good as 38, man, I'm going to be or half as good as 38. I'm in good shape. Very excited for the year ahead. And thank you for having me on the show every week. It's really fun. And what I love most is just these moments of like the ups and downs of the NBA season, where what happened to Wemby? He's got to play more like an a-hole. And then suddenly he turns into like the greatest player we've ever seen. And then he does a pumpkin on national TV. It's just the NBA season. It is There's so many chapters to an NBA season. I'm glad I do it every week with you, Kev. Thank you so much, man.
I very much love doing it, Tom. Have a good rest of your week. Everybody who's listening to the show as well, please give us a 5-star rating. If you're listening to the show on Spotify or Apple, a thumbs up on YouTube. It really does help us out. Thanks to Brett for producing. Thanks to Tom for joining. Hope you have a good rest of your weekend.